I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. By now, you've seen and heard the clip of Keyser Khan holding his pocket copy of the U.S. Constitution at the Democratic National Convention and asking Donald Trump whether he had read it. Since then, copies of the Constitution have been flying off the shelves of bookstores, and it's a top seller at Amazon. And that must make our guest, Jeffrey Rosen, very happy. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, just across the street from WHYY. He's also the author of a new book. It's called Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Brandeis served on the U.S. Supreme Court beginning in 1916 and left his mark on our laws and our thinking about ideas like free speech and privacy and the size and power of the federal government and corporations. We'll talk about Brandeis's legal legacy and some of the constitutional issues that we are hearing on the campaign trail this year. And Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It is wonderful to be back.
And it must be wonderful to know that the U.S. Constitution is a big seller.
It is wonderful. There's nothing more inspiring than seeing people reading the Constitution. And we were thrilled when our pocket Constitution sold out on Amazon. It'll be back in stock soon. And even more exciting, our online Constitution, which I really want readers and listeners to check out, hits rose 16% since Mr. Khan waived the Constitution. Everyone, you can go check it out at constitutioncenter.org. It's the leading nonpartisan interactive Constitution in the country. It's gotten 6 million hits since it launched in September, and it's really exciting to see citizens read the Constitution for themselves.
I mean, it's great for people, obviously, to read such an important document, but does it also tell us that we don't know, and perhaps it took someone born in another country to remind us about the importance of this document?
Yes, there was something so tangible about seeing him wave the physical copy, and I'm now waving mine as well.
I see it very well.
Here it is. It's the pocket Constitution, and it's great to look at them online, but there's something about carrying it around and being able to take it out and just consult it. The Constitution comes up so often in arguments every day in the presidential campaign. There's a new constitutional issue, to be able to take it out, look at the text, and then that provides a common framework for argument. It really lowers the temperature and also elevates the discussion, and that's why I love to carry the Constitution.
Well, you do have a new book, Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Why American Prophet? Why that word?
Brandeis was the most prophetic philosopher of both free speech and privacy in an age of new technologies in the 20th century. He was the most prophetic critic of what he called the curse of bigness in business and government since Thomas Jefferson. And if that weren't enough, he was the most influential person in persuading Woodrow Wilson and the British government to recognize a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And in addition to all that, he looked like a prophet, and people called him a prophet, and FDR would call him Old Isaiah, or My Dear Isaiah. So for all those reasons, I called him a prophet.
Well, I always like to know where people came from and how they got started. He was born, obviously, before the Civil War, which is interesting to think about. Born in Kentucky, his parents obviously were Jewish. They were immigrants. How did they end up in Kentucky? Do you know?
They fled the failed liberal revolutions of 1848 in Europe. They came from Prague, and they were called Pilgrims of 1848, seeking liberty in America. And they came to America, and they started in the Midwest, and they eventually found themselves in Kentucky because Brandeis's father, Adolf Brandeis, was a grain merchant, and he founded a not-so-successful grain factory, but he became a very successful smaller merchant of starch, and he managed a series of small businesses effectively. And for all those reasons, Brandeis throughout his life idealized the land and agrarian interests. And like Jefferson, he believed that only in small-scale communities, ideally farming communities, could people develop their faculties and become fully engaged citizens.
Was it a religious household?
No, it was not.
Was it an a-religious or anti-religious household?
It was not anti-religious. The family came from a strand of Judaism called Frankism, which was basically a precursor of Reform Judaism. And Brandeis's mother, Frederica, whom he idealized, said that she wanted to raise her children to believe that truth and morality and ethics were central and more important than religious observance. So therefore, the family didn't observe rituals. They were criticized for riding horses on Yom Kippur. But Brandeis never repudiated his religion. He just didn't identify as a religiously observant Jew. And that's what made it so remarkable that in his 50s, after having not paid much attention to Jewish issues at all, he, through a series of chance encounters, became the leader of the American Zionist movement and the most influential Jew of the 20th century.
And I do want to get to that, but let me just pause for a bit and talk about Thomas Jefferson. And you call him the Jewish Jefferson, or perhaps other people have as well, which is interesting to think about in the era of Hamilton. So the idea that Louis Brandeis and Hamilton probably would be on opposite sides of a lot of issues.
Yes, I picked the wrong founder because Hamilton is hot and Jefferson has all the bad songs.
Exactly. So it's very true,
it's
actually.
It's very true. But although I acknowledge very strongly at the beginning that Jefferson had a terrible blind spot, and that, of course, is race. And his inability to reconcile his owning slaves with his ideals in the Declaration of Independence is a stain on his legacy. Nevertheless, Jefferson represents a strain in our politics which has many appealing qualities. Most importantly, his champion of small business people, of farmers, of economic populism, and his opposition to oligarchs and financiers and monopolists. And Jefferson proposed an amendment to the Constitution that would have prohibited Congress from setting up corporations with exclusive influence. And it was Hamilton who was the champion of the financial classes, and Jefferson who championed the interests of the poor and the struggling. And it's really interesting that for much of American history, nearly two centuries, the Democratic Party really identified with this populist Jeffersonian strain, from Jefferson to Jackson to Brandeis and Wilson to FDR. And it wasn't until the 60s, when the party became importantly focused on protecting the interests of minorities and women, that economic populist strand dropped out. And it took a Bernie Sanders to resurrect it. But all honor to Jefferson, said Lincoln, when he gave his famous speech in Philadelphia. And therefore, I think we need to remember the honorable parts of Jefferson's legacies, which were embodied so dramatically by Louis Brandeis.
Do we know how Brandeis felt about things like slavery and what came after slavery and issues of race? Do we know where he stood on those?
He remembered hearing a gunshot at the last Battle of Bull Run. His mother was an abolitionist, and the family prided itself on sympathizing with the Union. But I do acknowledge right up front that Brandeis had something of a blind spot on race as well. He was not a racist by any means, and he was personally supportive of African Americans. But in his judicial opinions, he was silent.
Oh,
he basically just joined the majority in all the race cases that came before him. Sometimes they were pro-racial equality. More often they were not. But it was unfortunate that for someone who was such a crusader on equality for women and on economic equality and on free speech and privacy, race just did not engage him. And I think that was unfortunate.
He did go to Harvard Law School. You include a letter that I think one of his roommates wrote to his mother or a family member about Louis Brandeis. Quoting here, has a rather foreign look and is currently believed to have some Jew blood in him, though you would not suppose it from his appearance, tall, well-made, dark, beardless, and with the brightest eyes I've ever seen. Is supposed to know everything and to have it always in mind. The professors listen to his opinion with the greatest deference, and it is generally correct.
Yes, he was famous for getting the highest grades in the history of Harvard Law School. By some measures, they've never been surpassed, even though he never went to college by any general stretch. And even though he had eye trouble and people had to read to him, he had this Dekanovite discipline and just was this extraordinary intellectual in college. And those bright eyes that so many people commented on, I had the great honor and pleasure of meeting and being interviewed by Brandeis's great-grandson, Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch in New York. And he has the same eyes.
Is that
really
right?
Bright green-blue eyes, which is really cool to see.
Jew blood. I mean, I read that today, and it's shocking. But in what, 1878? Not so shocking?
Not so shocking. Brandeis definitely experienced anti-Semitism in Boston. His law partner, Charles Warren, co-wrote with him the most famous article on the right to privacy ever, but Warren's wife was so anti-Semitic that she refused to invite Brandeis to their home. And Brandeis also experienced some anti-Semitism in his hotly contested confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court. He waited 125 days from nomination to confirmation, a record that was only recently surpassed by Merrick Garland on July 19th, previously unsurpassed. And part of that opposition was to his religion. He was denounced by people like President William Howard Taft as an emotionalist and a socialist in terms that seem to have an anti-Semitic cast today. But the main opposition to Brandeis came not from his religion, but from the fact that he was perceived as a radical. And he remarkably rose above the anti-Semitism. He never commented on it. And even when he joined the Supreme Court and served next to the most virulently anti-Semitic and racist justice in Supreme Court history, James McReynolds, who was so unpleasant that he left the room when Brandeis spoke at the conferences and refused to acknowledge him, Brandeis just ignored McReynolds and let it roll off him.
He was known for something called the Brandeis Brief. What is that? Or what were they?
The first Brandeis brief was filed in a case called Mueller and Oregon, and the question was, are maximum hour laws for women constitutional? And Brandeis submitted reams of statistics and reports and citations to foreign factory workers to show that these laws actually were conducive to health. And he was helped in assembling this brief by his remarkable sister-in-law, Josephine Goldmark. And he was so impressed by her that he became an enthusiastic advocate of women's suffrage. But ever since then, the Brandeis brief, which so impressed the court that it cited the brief in its opinion and said this wonderful brief by Justice Brandeis, by Mr. Brandeis, has helped aid the court. This Brandeis brief inspired Thurgood Marshall when he filed his brief in Brown versus Board of Education, talking about the need for school desegregation because of its practical effects on African-American school kids. And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I had the thrill of interviewing for the book, and she said, I was influenced by the Brandeis brief when I filed my briefs arguing against gender discrimination in the 1970s.
I mean, would it be fair to say that what Brandeis was arguing was something based on facts or something even beyond the law, the effect of a law that a law might have on an individual or a group of people?
Yes, it is fair. I think he would say that the law, he did say in the speech called The Living Law, that the law should take account of contemporary realities and should be responsive to the needs of society. And therefore, he thought that rather than bloodless abstractions, it should be grounded in facts and empirics, and that pragmatism has influenced justices today, including Justice Stephen Breyer, who told me in the book that Brandeis was one of his heroes because of his emphasis on facts.
And we're almost on a break here, but you're saying that was a radical idea 100 years ago?
It was unusual, and it was Brandeis's innovation.
And that's Jeffrey Rosen, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. And he's got a new book, Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. We're talking about a little bit about Brandeis's life, but also his influence on the court, on the country. And we want to open the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jeffrey Rosen about Louis D. Brandeis. He sat on the U.S. Supreme Court, in fact, was confirmed 100 years ago, sat on the court for a number of years, and certainly left a legacy, left a mark on the country and on the court. He wrote a book. he wrote a book in 1914 called Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It, a book I think that could be written by Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Jill Stein. What did he write in this book?
It is remarkable, isn't it, that someone who wrote a book called Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It could be confirmed to the Supreme Court today. And you're absolutely right that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein are heirs in some degree to Brandeis, but there are differences, too. On the campaign trail, Bernie Sanders attributed his proposal to break up the banks to Theodore Roosevelt. But actually, it was Brandeis and Wilson who wanted to break up the banks because they feared the danger of size and too big to fail. Roosevelt wanted to create big regulatory bodies to oversee the big banks. And William Howard Taft, the last candidate in the election of 1912, wanted more vigorous antitrust enforcement. So remarkably, in that incredible election of 1912, all three candidates are committed to a form of trust busting. But it is Brandeis and Wilson who want to break up the banks. And then the next and then Brandeis goes on to write this incredible book, Other People's Money.
Yeah.
And the basic idea is an argument against too big to fail. Brandeis thinks that when any institution becomes too big, it's too complicated for people to understand the risks involved. And therefore, he attacked greedy financiers like his nemesis, J.P. Morgan, for taking reckless risks with other people's money by investing in complicated financial instruments whose value they couldn't possibly understand.
Does that sound familiar?
Sound familiar? Absolutely. It's credit default swaps right over again. And Brandeis absolutely predicted the crash of 29. He said in 1926, I want to register my bewilderment that more folks don't go broke. And he would have predicted the crash of 2008 on the same grounds because he understood that the limitations of human knowledge make it impossible to master really complicated financial instruments. So Morgan was his object in this book, and he thought that the web of oligarchic influence that Morgan controlled came not just from his fortune, since Rockefeller was richer, but from the power that he exerted on interlocking directorates and the boards of railroads and other banks and other interests that his henchmen, as Brandeis viewed them, controlled. So it really was an argument about the dangers of financial oligarchy, the political power that can result from concentrated financial power. And as you say, this is a debate that we're very much having today.
Indeed. And does this go back to his affiliation with Thomas Jefferson, who also, I mean, that sort of small government agrarian viewpoint about the country?
Yes, very much. Jefferson, too, an enemy of financiers and the oligarchic classes. Jefferson, like Brandeis, is not anti-capitalist, but he's anti-financiers. That's why Jefferson's great battle with Hamilton, as we know from the show, was right about the bank and the constitutionality of the power to charter a Bank of the United States, which Jefferson denied. And Brandeis, who, unlike Jefferson, was not a strict constructionist, shared Jefferson's view that American history was a conflict between virtuous small business people and agrarian interests on the one hand and greedy monopolists and financiers on the other.
I'm interested in his perspective on then the federal government and whether he saw that as an impediment to what perhaps state governments or local governments could do, or what were his views?
They were complicated. He believed primarily in the states, which he called famously laboratories of democracy. He thought that states could be engines of experimentation for useful reform. And the main progressive reforms that he championed as an advocate, like minimum wage and maximum hour laws, all came from the states. But he was also the architect of some federal regulatory bodies, like the Federal Reserve and the Federal Trade Commission. But Brandeis insisted that they should be mixed. The Federal Reserve would have state banks supervised by some federal appointments, and the Federal Trade Commission would have the power to bring prosecutions, but not to regulate directly. Hmm. So it was a rather complicated way of dispersing power. And he constantly quoted the framers by saying that their main concern was not efficiency, but liberty. So he was not completely opposed to the federal government. He voted to uphold, as a Supreme Court justice, much of the New Deal, but he did join a unanimous Supreme Court in striking down three centralizing elements of the New Deal. And I begin the book with this dramatic scene where he summons to his apartment in Washington Franklin Roosevelt's advisors and says, unless the president stops this business of centralization, we're going to strike it down. He's got to get the message. And Brandeis did indeed, in his prophetic way, vote to strike down elements of the first New Deal, which was more centralizing, and the second New Deal, which, as Arthur Schlesinger said, was inspired by the spirit of Brandeis and Wilson, as opposed to the first New Deal, which breathed the spirit of Theodore Roosevelt and Herbert Croly, the editor of the New Republic. The second New Deal focused more on regulating financial instruments at the state level and was less focused on centralized federal regulation.
Be interesting to know how he felt, or perhaps you know how he felt about things like desegregation, where, you know, in so many ways, the civil rights battles were fought state by state, on the state and local level, how he would have felt about that or how he did feel about that.
That is interesting, and there is no recorded information that I can see about what he thought about that. Unlike Woodrow Wilson, he was not a racist who voted to segregate the federal government, but desegregation cases didn't come before the court when he was on it, and therefore we don't have a strong sense of what he thought.
Let me ask about – he did finally make it on the court. This was after 125 days, something like that. So eventually – and what was the – what did the Senate vote? What was the vote tally?
The vote was not close because the Senate was Democratic, like the president, and therefore he had a comfortable majority. But it should have been much more lopsided. It was opposition based on his perceived economic radicalism and anti-Semitism that made it as close as it was.
He was a proponent of free speech. I mean, I guess in a and maybe that's an understatement. I'm not sure or not. You can correct me if you'd like, Jeffrey Rosen.
It's true. It's very true that he was a proponent of free speech. But in addition
based
to
on
that,
what? Yeah.
He was the greatest proponent of free speech of the 20th century. And Justice Elena Kagan said that in the book, and I agree. And his beautiful opinion in Whitney versus California, which I want listeners to check out. You can go online and Google it and read his incredible concurring opinion, which is not long, is the most powerful statement of the purpose of free speech in the 20th century. And Brandeis is inspired by Jefferson and also by the ancient Greeks. He's one of his favorite books was called The Greek Polis by Alfred Zimmern. And he sees in Greek Athenian 5th century democracy a model of engaged citizens who, after hearing arguments on all sides, are able to engage in reasoned deliberation so that they can fully develop their faculties and engage in self-government. And that's why in this incredible Whitney opinion, he says we have to protect even the most hateful speech. Unless speech is intended to and likely to cause imminent violence, and there's no time for reasoned deliberation, we need to hear arguments on all sides, and therefore the best response to hateful counsels is good ones. It's an argument for counter speech. It's become the cornerstone of the American free speech tradition. Unlike Europe, which bans hate speech, we protect the most hateful speech. It's the grounds for the conclusion of most scholars that Donald Trump's recent comments about Second Amendment people maybe taking things matters into their own hands would be protected by the First Amendment because of Brandeis's notion that, you know, unless the speech is intended to and likely to cause violence, basically go assassinate that person now.
That kind of, that very right. direct kind of speech.
That would be a true threat. But otherwise, what's called expressive advocacy can't be banned. And in Brandeis's day, the government was actually putting people in jail, like Eugene V. Debs, the socialist candidate for president. Debs had made a mild criticism of the draft, and he was imprisoned on the grounds that his speech might lead people to resist the draft in the future. And Brandeis, who'd initially supported some of those convictions, changed his mind and came to believe that unless the speech is intended to and likely to cause resistance to the law or violence, it must be protected because of his incredible faith in reason. And that's why that beautiful Whitney opinion talking about how the founders believed that the purpose of government was to leave men free to develop their faculties is so inspiring. So he inspires me, he inspires all of us, and it's just a beautiful cornerstone of the American free speech tradition.
And the idea that you counter that speech with more speech, I mean, to sort of boil it down to the essence of what he was saying.
Yes, and so relevant in an age when in Europe, you know, there are not only calls but legal requirements that Facebook and Google take down speech that is hateful or which assaults people's dignity. And Brandeis would have strongly disagreed and believed better to have counter speech rather than takedowns.
Interesting coming from a man who had to deal with some anti-Semitism and people saying things about him or removing themselves from a room if he walked in, that he would be so passionate about speech.
Yes, and I think he really had faith also that in time, Americans, through reasoned deliberation, would come to accept the value of a multicultural society. He called it cultural pluralism and believed that by embracing their ethnic identity, all groups could contribute to the beauty of the American whole. And he was optimistic about democracy. So whenever I despair about democracy or wonder whether or not to be optimistic, I think of Brandeis and think of his faith in the American people and his faith in reason. and I cheer up and read the Constitution and feel good again, all over again.
Well, we like to feel good, Jeffrey Rosen. And Jeffrey Rosen is our guest on Radio Times today, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is here in Philadelphia, in fact, right across the street from WHYY. And we're talking about his new book called Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Getting a bit of a history lesson here, but obviously history that has such importance and such resonance today. Also thinking about how Brandeis thought about things like privacy, and of course, with wiretapping and the NSA, Snowden, WikiLeaks, we're dealing with the same issue today. How did Brandeis think about privacy, especially privacy and the government?
So, listeners, one more homework assignment, if you'll forgive one. I know it's August and school is out, but this is fun and it'll be worth reading. Google his great opinion in Olmsted versus United States, which is the greatest statement of privacy of the 20th century. And Olmsted is a case involving wiretapping, and the government is putting wires on the sidewalk under a suspected bootlegger's office, and they eavesdrop on his conversations and they convict him. And he says the conviction has to be thrown out. There was no valid warrant. A majority of the court, in an opinion written by Chief Justice Taft, says, you're out of luck. There was no trespass. There was public property, and therefore they can eavesdrop all they like. And Brandeis is incredibly prophetic here. He has in his desk drawer this clipping about a new technology, television, but he misunderstands TV. He thinks it's a two-way technology where people can see each other on both sides. He anticipates Skype, basically, and webcams.
Exactly.
And totally gets the internet.
Way ahead of his own self, right?
Way ahead of his time. So his law clerk says, you can't just look out of a TV and see people on both sides. So he leaves out the reference, but in the opinion, he alludes to the future of cloud computing and the internet and says, I won't read, this is a paraphrase, but it's basically, unless you can find the page number quickly.
I think I have it, 141?
141, okay, let's find
Discovery it. Discovery and invention?
Do you want to read it or should I?
Well, I have it right here.
Okay,
great. I'll do the first sentence, and if it needs more, you can do
Beautiful.
That.
Beautiful, yeah.
He writes, discovery and invention have made it possible for the government by means far more effective than stretching upon the rack to obtain disclosure in court of what is whispered in the closet.
That's beautiful. And then if you go down a few sentences, you see him anticipating the internet where he says, ways may someday be developed by which the government, without removing papers from secret drawers and reproduce them in court, and by which it will be enabled to expose to a jury the most intimate occurrences of the home, advances in the psychic and related sciences may bring means of exploring unexpressed beliefs, thoughts, and emotions. Wow. I mean, he's anticipating fMRI technology.
Yes.
And a time when, without breaking into someone's home, we can wiretap on an email database or a cloud database, for example, and expose through WikiLeaks or otherwise to the world the most intimate secrets of the home. And this, the crucial point of this passage is the majority of the court had said, in the old days, you had to physically trespass on someone's home to commit an unreasonable search or seizure of their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Brandeis says we have to translate the amendment so it protects the same amount of privacy in the age of the wires that it did in the horse and buggy age. So he's saying invasions, even without physical trespass, should be considered unconstitutional if they can expose a lot of intimate information. And that provides incredibly useful guidance at a time when we can fly drones in the air and track people door to door for 24/7 without physical trespass. Does that violate the Fourth Amendment? The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't clearly said yes or no. Brandeis unhesitatingly would say yes, because it can reveal so much intimate information about what he so beautifully called our thoughts, sensations, and emotions.
Be interesting to think what he thought he would have thought about someone like Edward Snowden and releasing all that information from the NSA.
It is interesting. I'd love to channel him on all these questions, asking WWBD, what would Brandeis do? And on the one hand, Brandeis would have been, I think, appalled by mass warrantless data collection, which would have, according to this Olmsted decision, have constituted an unreasonable search and seizure and been unconstitutional, even with a warrant, he said in the Olmsted case. Mass surveillance that can reveal a lot about us may be unconstitutional. On the other, he wasn't big on lawlessness, and he also was not although he believed that sunlight is the best disinfectant and advocated transparency, especially of campaign donations and secret corporate activities. He also believed that privacy was important for dignity, so mass data dumps without any redaction might have troubled him. It's a hard question, obviously, and he would have seen all sides of it.
So what would Brandeis do? WW?
BD.
Yes, exactly. What would he think about then Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision of a couple of years ago?
Well, there I asked Justice Ginsburg that question, and she said he would not have been a fan of Citizens United, not at all. Because Citizens United implicated several of Brandeis's main concerns, his concern about the danger of corporate influence on elections, his concern about size, and his belief that all people had to contribute to public discourse. You can argue most of this round or flat. To take the opposite side, he believed so strongly in free speech and on hearing all sides of an argument that the case on the other side would be corporations should have their perspective introduced as well. But Brandeis is centrally interested in free speech as a natural right, an inherent right of human beings. He's a Jeffersonian, and his theory of free speech comes from Jefferson's idea that all of us have to develop our faculties, which begin with passions at the bottom to reason at the top. So Brandeis actually cites in his great free speech opinions Jefferson's first inaugural and also his letter to the Connecticut pastor about the importance of protecting freedom of opinion because of the need to develop our faculties. For all those reasons, I think Brandeis's free speech was really rooted in the idea of natural persons, and he would not have been a fan of Citizens United.
One of the arguments, though, I guess, in favor of Citizens United is that corporations are people, too.
They are, and I don't think that Brandeis would have bought that argument because he was a champion of the very progressive era laws that Citizens United struck down. There were the Tillman Act and a series of laws from 1908 championed by Theodore Roosevelt and Republicans as well as Democrats restricted corporate speech because of the danger that it was posing in state politics. The Montana Supreme Court cited that legislative history, citing laws that Brandeis himself had enthusiastically supported as an advocate, and the U.S. Supreme Court refused to reconsider that decision in a recent case.
We're almost having a break here. I'm thinking also money and speech. I mean, there's also, with the Buckley case, this joining of money and speech.
Yes, and, again, I'm freelancing here, and listeners should feel free to reach their own conclusions, but he believed that money could exercise oligarchic influence in politics and wants to keep big money out of big government.
He is Louis D. Brandeis, and our guest is Jeffrey Rosen, author of a book called Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org and at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, Jeffrey Rosen is our guest, again, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, author of a new book called Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Let me get John from Valley Forge to join us on Radio Times. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. This is really cool.
That's great. I'm glad you think so. Go ahead, John.
I just had a quick question. So it seems as though Jefferson, and I'm sorry that the judge's name slips my brain right now, though I've been hearing
Brandeis
it frequently today, is if they were so small government, agrarian government in Jefferson's case, in order to regulate banks and large money interests and things, don't you then need to increase the size of the government to do that regulating? And I guess maybe they just meant small government in other ways. And it's interesting in the context of today, it seems as though Jefferson is invoked by a lot of people that are saying, government, get out of my hair, get out of my business. But in this situation, it seems as though you're saying they are more government involvement in regulation and breaking things down. So it just seems like there's a difference in that, I guess. I'm sorry if I...
It's great. It's a great question. I see Jeffrey Rosen nodding his head. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
It is a great question, John. And for Theodore Roosevelt reached exactly the conclusion that you just suggested, that because of the threats of these big banks, the proper response was big government. And Roosevelt wanted to create a bureau of corporations that would have regulated these big banks. But Wilson disagreed and Brandeis disagreed. They so mistrusted big government that they wanted to break up the banks or prevent them from forming in the first place rather than creating these big new regulatory bodies. So the modern version of that is the Volcker Rule, that would prevent banks from trading on their own accounts, and also the proposal, which never passed in Dodd-Frank, which would have imposed caps on size and required banks to have a certain capitalization requirement and prevented them from getting too big in the first place. So Brandeis and Wilson are so principled that they don't want to create those big regulatory bodies. They just want smaller banks in the first place.
Interesting, John. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get Beth from Plymouth Meeting to join our conversation. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just remember reading about Louis Brandeis and being a proponent of the eugenic movement in the United States. I'd like to hear any comment you might have about that.
Absolutely. And this was another very important case that came before the Supreme Court.
It's a great question. Brandeis himself was not a proponent of the eugenics movement, unlike Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was an enthusiastic eugenicist and supported these laws to so-called improve the race and including mandatory sterilization. But Brandeis did, you're absolutely right, join Holmes's infamous 8-to-1 opinion upholding mandatory sterilization laws. Holmes famously said, three generations of imbeciles is enough. And he said that it was perfectly constitutional to mandate what he called sterilization of imbeciles. The difference between Holmes and Brandeis is that although Brandeis and Holmes and almost all of the court, aside from Justice Butler, who was the only devout Catholic on the court and thought that the laws were bad on those grounds, almost the entire court believed these laws were constitutional, Brandeis didn't personally support them, unlike Holmes, who did personally support them. So I don't know if that redeems him a bit, but you're right in calling attention to this unfortunate part of his legacy.
Beth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And just I believe he was a guest at the Constitution Center. We also had a guest on the show a couple of months ago, wrote a book called Imbecile about this particular case, just delving deep into who this woman was and how she ended up being a case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, that's Adam Cohn, who wrote a wonderful book, Imbeciles. And it's a really shameful history. And it's striking, as Adam Cohn writes in his great book, how most of the main progressives of the day, including the major progressive religious denominations, were enthusiastic eugenicists. And it was the more conservative religious denominations of Catholics, Protestants, and Jews who opposed it on religious grounds. But it's just a good caution that stuff that we techno-enthusiasts may think in our time are really great can seem, in retrospect, to be chilling offenses against liberty.
So how did Louis D. Brandeis become an American Zionist?
So it was a series of chance encounters that began in the summer of 1910. First, a guy called Jacob de Haas, who was the American secretary of Theodor Herzl, the founder of Modern Zionist, came to interview Brandeis in Boston. And in the course of the interview, de Haas mentioned Louis Dembitz was a noble Jew, and Dembitz was Brandeis's revered uncle, his mother's brother. He was the only Orthodox Jew in the family, and Brandeis so admired him that learning that he was a Zionist provoked him to learn more about Zionism. Then later that year, Brandeis represented Jewish garment workers in a strike in New York, and he was so impressed by their intellectualism and their empathy, their ability to see the other side of their mostly Jewish employers, and the fact that they used their leisure time, their spare time, to educate themselves, to read Tolstoy and Industrial Reports, and that they were Zionists, that this first encounter with Eastern European immigrants made him think hard about it. So those two events, combined with his prodigious reading, convinced him that the Jewish people need to be preserved and they need their own country. He said the Jews, like every other nationality, and he called the Jews a nationality, deserves to be a majority in at least one country. Hmm. And then he had to deal with the fact that he had previously supported Theodore Roosevelt and denounced hyphenated Americanism as a form of dual loyalty. He came to believe by being better Jews, we can be better Americans. By embracing our ethnic identity, we can contribute to the American whole. And then soon he becomes the head of the American Zionist movement. He raises millions of dollars and he persuades the American and British government to recognize a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
That was the Balfour Declaration.
The Balfour Declaration, which was actually run by Brandeis before it went through the State Department, and Brandeis advising Wilson from the court against something that could never happen today, but he remained actively involved as a Wilson advisor.
Did he imagine an Israel, as we know it now, an Israel as a kind of agrarian state based on his ideas, his beliefs that he shared with Thomas Jefferson?
Yes, he saw Israel or Palestine as an agrarian Jeffersonian paradise where the people would be mostly rooted in the land, where the equal rights of Arabs and Jews would be scrupulously respected, and where the agricultural efforts on small-scale kibbutzim would lead to the flowering of milk and honey, would help both Arabs and Jews, and would make Israel democratic, free, egalitarian, and also socialist, basically, in its communal ownership of land. None of those.
I was going to say, yes, what would Brandeis think
WWBD,
today?
It didn't quite turn out the way he hoped. He had a very idealistic view of Israel, which he also thought would be a kind of mini 5th century Athens.
Oh, interesting. Let me read a tweet from Mitchell. Do you think Brandeis's roots being in Louisville rather than the Northeast had any sort of philosophical or judicial significance, the fact that he was from the South?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it fired his Jeffersonianism. It fired his emphasis on agriculture. When he met a Jewish immigrant who'd invented wild rice, a Zionist, he said this was the most exciting invention he'd ever discovered, much like Jefferson, who thought that one of his greatest accomplishments was importing a special variety of rice and grain to the United States. So I think that very much Brandeis's Southern roots made him a Jeffersonian and influenced his agrarianism throughout his life.
Let me get Jack from Newcastle, Delaware, to join our conversation. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is this. Would Brandeis still be such a staunch defender of hate speech if he had lived through World War II and seen the rise of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, where millions and millions of Jews and others were killed?
It's a good question, Jack. Go ahead, Jack.
It's a great question, and I don't doubt that the Holocaust, which he anticipated, he said the Jews have to leave Germany or disaster will strike. He died in 1941, so he never learned the worst, but he was livid at the British government for imposing immigration quotas and preventing people from going to Palestine. And he might have been radicalized by that experience. But I don't think he would have changed his views about speech, because he really felt that the best response to hate speech was counter speech. And so much empirical evidence confirms that on Facebook and Twitter today, that really the countries that suppress hate speech, like Germany and France, are hardly paragons of philo-Semitism, whereas America has done better by adopting the Brandeisian position. I think his faith in reason would have prevailed even despite the horrors of the Holocaust.
Let me ask you about some current day things. And of course, Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. The Senate is frankly refusing to hold confirmation hearings. As you said, he now passes Brandeis for the amount of days that are waiting for confirmation or not. Where does that leave the U.S. Supreme Court? We've got 8 members of the court. They gave some decisions at the end of June. How does having an empty chair there, you think, affect the court, the functioning of the court?
Well, in some cases, 4-4 decisions have meant upholding the lower court decision and leaving things unsettled. Some of those decisions have been in a more liberal direction, like the one involving union speech. Others have been more conservative. But what can Brandeis teach us about this? One thing he teaches us is that justices attacked as radical in their days can actually be consensus builders. Brandeis had crossed swords with President Taft before his appointment, but once Taft became Chief Justice, he and Brandeis joined in a series of unanimous decisions because of their concern for the institutional legitimacy of the court. And I could imagine Merrick Garland, if he is confirmed, despite the claim of Republicans that he would be a radical liberal, joining with a sort of pragmatic centrist majority in creating consensus.
I'm also interested in, and because we're in the middle of a campaign here and we're hearing from both Hillary Clinton and also Donald Trump various things about what they would do if they become president of the United States. We hear from Hillary Clinton, she's going to get rid of Citizens United shortly after become office. Donald Trump has talked about Hillary Clinton essentially getting rid of the Second Amendment. What kind of power do presidents have to get rid of either amendments or laws?
Presidents have no power to overturn Supreme Court decisions that are based on the Constitution beyond supporting constitutional amendments. And Hillary Clinton has said that she would support a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, and she could do that. And as we know, it's hard to pass an amendment, but she could try it that way. She could also appoint Supreme Court justices who would vote to overturn Citizens United. And I think both sides feel there's a real chance that a Democratic majority on the court might indeed overturn Citizens United in time. In terms of eliminating the Second Amendment, if you look closely at what Hillary Clinton has said, she has refused to say whether she thinks that the Supreme Court decision recognizing the Second Amendment as an individual right of self-defense is correct or not.
And that's the Heller decision.
That's the Heller decision. She dodged that question. She did say that she stressed correctly that the court has said that reasonable regulations are consistent with the Second Amendment, and the court itself has emphasized that. So the question of whether the Second Amendment is or is not an individual right is an important question. The best way listeners can make up their own minds is to check out the interactive constitution, constitutioncenter.org, where we literally have the leading liberal and conservative scholars on the Second Amendment, if you click on the Second Amendment, describing what they agree and disagree about the Second Amendment. And interestingly, both of them say that the Second Amendment did have an individual rights core, but it's still consistent with reasonable regulations. The Second Amendment debate has been polarized, and it really is the case that given the court statement that reasonable regulations are perfectly constitutional and the fact that most regulations that have been considered in the wake of Heller have been upheld by lower courts, right, if we have a gun control, lack of gun control regulations in America, it's more the reluctance or inability of legislatures to pass them rather than of courts that are striking them down.
And didn't Scalia say a part of that decision, the Heller decision giving people the individual right, also upheld the right to regulate?
Absolutely.
Guns and firearms.
He said explicitly that reasonable regulations involving felon disenfranchisement and guns restricted around sensitive places like hospitals and so forth are perfectly constitutional. So really, blaming it all on the court is not fair on the campaign trail. More important for the candidates to say, what kind of regulations do you believe are consistent with the Constitution and which ones should be passed?
Not to be partisan here, but I'd be just curious about your response. And this goes back a month or so when Donald Trump essentially called out a judge who is ruling on Trump University, calling him Mexican. He's not. He's an American. But the fact that he was so overt and personal in his criticism, even condemnation of Judge Curiel.
Well, thanks for recognizing the National Constitution Center's nonpartisan mandate, so I'll just try to be descriptive as possible. And I can say historically that attacks on judges go way back. Theodore Roosevelt became a huge opponent of judicial review and called on Congress to be able to overturn judicial decisions by popular vote, and also called out individual judges. And generally, it's important for the branches to respect each other's independence and to recognize that, you know, each of them has a role to play.
Whoever is the next president is probably going to have the chance to nominate. They get nominated, and then it's the Senate that signs off on it. One, two, maybe even as many as three justices. I mean, that could have an enormous impact going forward.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so three, maybe we know that Justice Scalia has to be replaced. That's one. Justice Ginsburg has signaled that she may want to retire. That's two. Justice Breyer might well retire. And it's possible that Justice Kennedy could as well. It's not implausible.
It could be four.
It could be four. And I know in every election, people are saying this one is going to determine the future of the court. This one really is. And whether you are a Republican or a Democrat, a Trump supporter or a Clinton supporter, you should vote for the candidate whose views of the Constitution best coincide with your own, because the next president will fundamentally shape the future of the court for generations to come.
Well, Jeffrey Rosen, always a pleasure. Thank you for running across the street and joining us today in Radio Times.
So great to be here. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And he is the president and the CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. And we've been talking about his new book, Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.